BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday, the 2nd of December edition of Dialect. Nuclear site from a local campaigner who's been looking at the health effects of the existing nuclear power stations on residents in the area. Bristol doctors have been campaigning against a disturbing rise in civilians killed by British troops who are guarding the opium harvest in Afghanistan. We have Malcolm Greaves' weekly episode of Side with Rosie, Jeff Sparks' What's on Guide for the Week, and Matthew Heap's If I Were Prime Minister, which this week has an educational slant. All that and more coming up after this week's news roundup with Tony Gosling.
British-Pakistani terror suspect Rashid Rauf is still alive, his lawyer told the BBC on Monday, saying that reports that he had died in a US missile attack in Pakistan were fake. The alleged Al-Qaeda mastermind of a 2006 transatlantic jet liquid bombing conspiracy was reportedly killed at the weekend in a US raid in a northwestern border district that's known a known stronghold of Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants. "We don't believe that this story is true. It's a fake story," lawyer Hasmat Ali Habib told BBC Radio, adding, "We still believe that my client Rashid is alive." He noted that requests for Ralph's body to be returned to his family had not been answered. "This is a new technique of the government to dispose of the cases like Rashid or other missing people," he said. Ralph supposedly died Saturday when a missile hit a tribesman's house in the village of Al-Qil, a Pakistani security official told Agence France-Presse. The strike site is in a lawless tribal territory, and militants there usually surround the place after such attacks, preventing access of government representatives or the army, before burying the bodies themselves. Rauf was arrested in 2006 in Pakistan over the bomb plot, and 24 people were detained in Britain in a major swoop. A day later, a massive security operation at London's Heathrow Airport resulted in mass cancellations for several days, amid fears of a terrorist attack using liquid explosives on London flights bound for North America. The Foreign Office said it was probing reports that Rauf had been killed. "We're currently investigating this at the moment, but we do not have any information," a Foreign Office spokesman said. On the 12th of November, a housing association Places for People executed an eviction order on 87 Ashley Road, a squatted building occupied by 20 people who are now homeless. Squatters say the building was unused by Places for People for 4 years and left empty until May 2008 when the squatters moved in. They say Places for People have refused all attempts to negotiate an agreement, repeatedly submitted incorrect possession claims to Bristol magistrates, and threatened illegal eviction. At one stage, the sitting magistrate called Places for People's representation a right dog's breakfast. As bailiffs and builders working on behalf of Places for People entered the property, several squatters moved onto the roof to resist eviction and have been living on the roof now for over 2 weeks. As far as the courts are concerned, the eviction has been served despite protests taking place on the roof still. Builders have boarded up all normal exit points from the roof, leaving the roof protesters no safe immediate access. Places for People have instructed builders to render the property uninhabitable by removing all fixtures and fittings. The protest is part of a continuing concern over Places for People's treatment of empty properties and its selling off of rental stock on the open market. Places for People are selling properties via the shared ownership scheme while not replacing rental properties for those most in need. A worse deal for low-income families seeking decent accommodation. A South Texas grand jury has indicted Vice President Dick Cheney, former Attorney General Albert Alberto Gonzalez on charges related to the alleged abuse of prisoners in Willacy County's federal detention centres. The indictment criticises Cheney's investment in the Vanguard Group, which holds interests in private prison companies running the federal detention centres. It accuses Cheney of a conflict of interest and at least misdemeanour assaults on detainees by working through the prison companies. Gonzalez is accused of using his position while in office to stop an investigation into abuses at his own federal detention centres. And that story was from legitgov.org. Are we really just going through a credit crunch? Or is the financial crisis something altogether more catastrophic? Well, local economics author and ex-researcher for the New Economics Foundation, Martin Summers, predicted a catastrophe here on Dialect way back in the summer, demanding that Britain's private banks would have to be nationalised, cash points and all, to control the runaway banks. If you missed that, then check out Martin on YouTube. Anyway, Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, has finally come round to Martin's point of view and declared last week, "We should not shy away from nationalisation if that proves to be necessary. It would be an extremely brave person who ruled anything out. We will take whatever action we feel is necessary to steer the economy back into calmer waters," he said. And according to William Endall, a writer from Montreal University's internationally recognised Centre for the Research on Globalisation, this is the worst financial crisis not since the 1929 Wall Street crash, but the worst for 500 years. He points out that on Friday, November the 21st, the world came within a hair's breadth of the most colossal financial collapse in history, according to bankers on the inside of events with whom I have contact. The trigger was the bank which only 2 years ago was America's largest, Citigroup. The size of the US government de facto nationalisation of the $2 trillion banking institution is an indication of shocks yet to come in other major US and perhaps European banks thought to be too big to fail. So for more on the unreported near collapse last week of Citigroup, go to globalresearch.ca. And finally, author and professor David Ray Griffin knows his work is referred to by officials in the media as theory, and he has a rebuttal. Official theory is itself a conspiracy theory. In a companion volume to 2004's New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, David Ray Griffin provides corrections, raises new issues and discusses the two most important official reports about 9/11. The 9/11 Commission report and the National Institute of Standards and Technology report onto the Twin Towers. Both prepared by people, he says, highly responsive to the wishes of the White House. And riddled with omission and distortion from beginning to end, he says. Griffin addresses many points in an exhaustive detail, from the physical impossibility of the official explanation of the tower's collapse through the Commission's failure to scrutinise the administration, and to NIST's contradiction of its own scientists to the eyewitness and scientific testimony in direct opposition to official claims. Citing hundreds of sources, Griffin's detailed analysis is far from reactionary or delusional, building a case that, though not conclusive, raises enough valid and disturbing questions to make his call for a new investigation more convincing than ever. And it's recommended as Book of the Week by the Publishers Journal website. The book is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up and the Exposé by David Ray Griffin, published by Interlink on Olive Branch Press.
Thank you, Tony. For many years, public confidence of the nuclear power industry has been sinking, just as the true costs have gradually emerged as being so much it couldn't be privatised. But just when you thought nuclear power industry would be scrapped, it's been announced there has been a buyout by a French company, and all of a sudden, it's bouncing back. The rehabilitation of the nuclear industry is at hand right now. What with the effects of climate change and fears about rising water levels, some see nuclear power as a more climate-friendly alternative to coal and gas-fired power stations. The Bristol Channel, right here, is one of the most dense nuclear sites in the world, with Winfrith in Wales, Oldbury, Berkeley and the two Hinkley power stations near Bridgewater all discharging into the Severn Estuary. The main site Hinkley is just upwind of Bristol, which may well catch the brunt of any radiation cloud if Hinkley were the victim of either a terrorist attack or a serious accident. Well, to find out about the health effects and the future plans for Hinkley, I'm joined by Colin Rogers of various organisations, in fact. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Colin.
Hello, yes, I belong to Parents Concerned About Hinkley, and also the Green World Trust, and I'm on the national dialogues called Safe Grounds on Nuclear Decommissioning and the Disposal of Waste. I would say that with regards to health effects, Parents Concerned About Hinckley were famous in doing a door-to-door survey. This was because the Primary Healthcare Trust refused to allow people, say, in universities to have a coded access to the health histories of members of the public. They hid behind the idea that patient confidentiality could not be violated. We got round that by knocking on doors, and over a third of the population were both in and responded that they were quite happy to join our survey. Stop Hinckley, another group, has commissioned a health study, and Professor Chris Busby found a near doubling of breast cancer mortality in women living near Burnham North. These results have been refuted by the Primary Healthcare Trust, but every time we try to pin them down, they seem to be very adept at wriggling out of the correct area. For instance, downwind of Hinckley, they choose areas that are not downwind of Hinckley. And every time we look at their figures, they seem to be using a cruder statistical base than Professor Chris Busby used.
Right, so they haven't proven the powers that be to be very understanding to public's concern. What does that tell you about the government's attitude to nuclear now? Because, I mean, it's worth reiterating. In 2003, the Government Energy Review produced a report that came down against nuclear power. What's changed so dramatically?
It's very strange, but remember, during the Wilson era, there was, and during Churchill's administration, there was a dash towards nuclear because the UK was seen to be losing out on the world stage. A lot of the interest in nuclear technology was to be able to own our own military capabilities. And a recent Channel 4 documentary highlighted the haste with which this program was followed. Unfortunately, if you stop to think about the military situation now, it only takes a terrorist to knock out a nuclear power station, and with a meltdown effect like Chernobyl, two counties would be uninhabitable. If you look at Chernobyl, an area around Chernobyl about the size of Somerset and Devon is uninhabitable. But in the case of the Severn Estuary, the prevailing westerly wind would mean that places like Bristol would be more liable to be affected. And it must be remembered that after Chernobyl, areas as far away as North Wales were affected by radiation entering livestock. Even now, my brother-in-law's business has to check the radiation on sheep that are being slaughtered to make sure that they are fit for human consumption.
We have a massive energy problem, given that we've now run out of North Sea gas, more or less, and a lot of people be of the opinion that it's going to be incredibly difficult to try and fill that gap, this huge gap that's coming up, with the enormous amount of renewable energy that will be needed. How many wind farms are we going to be able to build? Surely nuclear is a very practical method, given that we haven't had any leak in this country.
I think it should be borne in mind that Michael Meacher, in the last administration, well, the last environment minister, was one of the people who quoted a very well-known statistic that, in terms of pure economics, nuclear is 2.5 times more expensive than wind to set up, 4 or 5 times more expensive than coal or gas. And, in fact, the cheapest power in the UK, electric power, at 2.5p per unit, comes from the hydroelectric schemes in Scotland. And it's important to realise that when government economists are quoting and assessing figures, they tend to think of cost rather than value. If you look at the various schemes, including a tidal reef for Minehead Aberthaw, using the similar technology that's in the hydroelectric schemes in Scotland, you will have potential for harvesting free energy for hundreds of years. If you don't know about the tidal reef, I suggest people look at the SevenTidal.com website or under the Green World Trust website. The tidal reef is one of many projects between Minehead and Aberthaw, which would not only create more electricity at a cheaper cost than the proposed Hinckley new build, but also provide an ability to withstand the possibilities of a tidal surge and the worst scenarios that have been stated about sea rise.
What exactly is being planned at Hinkley, and by whom?
Well, EDF, the French company, have bought land next to Hinkley Power Station, and the proposal is for two massive pressure water reactors. Now, these reactors were originally a design for nuclear submarines, and they work under a pressure dome, and the containment, although, of course, I understand this is debatable between the industry and opponents, the containment seems much more sensitive to attack.
Right.
In fact, we've had a wonderful little debate going over the years when it was said that these pressure water reactors were robust. So the industry said, there's no problem with these pressure water reactors. The no-fly zone over nuclear power stations, of course, says something different. And when a company wanted to put wind turbines on the site next to this proposal, the objection was, well, what happens if a blade comes off of one of these turbines that hits the reactor? Now, I recently had a fascinating conversation with people of the Environment Agency, seniors in the Environment Agency, who were explaining in great detail how closely they monitor the whole area of the estuary and how they're looking for tiny particles of nuclear material that may have escaped, and they're looking for any large-scale problems that may arise. The only thing is they'd omitted to realise that there is a, or wasn't quite recently, a World War II mine on the banks next to Hinkley, which was recently, only a few months ago, towed from Hinkley over to Sturt Island. By the way, the Environment Agency, not being locals, call it Sturt. Just shows how much they know about this area. And it was blown up when the tide was high and created a plume of many hundreds of tons of water, about 150 foot. So I'm not very convinced about the reliability of safety in the area.
Well, tell me a little bit more. Your group, Parents Concerned About Hinkley, have been knocking on doors and asking people and trying to put together statistics. Tell me a little bit more about the health implications that are already potentially in place now as a result of nuclear.
Well, according to Professor Busby, there's a cluster of leukemia and breast cancer in the region around Hinkley. This is hotly opposed by the Primary Healthcare Trust. But if you want to look at the details and decide for yourself, the Stop Hinkley website has chapter and verse. And also, Richard Bramwell, the low-level radiation campaign, produced a wonderful write-up called Gotcha. And that's on April 2008 of the Radioactive Times. But you can also find references to it under the Stop Hinkley website.
In reference to the quite prominent figure in the nuclear world, John Large, who you've sort of described as the Red Adair of the nuclear industry, tell me a little bit about him, because there was a meeting recently which he was speaking at on it.
Yes, John Large is well known by both sides of the debate because he is an internationally respected nuclear operative. He began his life actually as a technician working in the Windscale Sellafield area. And he describes his early innocence when he used to see seagulls rising and landing on the open water during the winter. The water was open in the cooling pools because the radioactive spent fuel rods were underneath and giving off sufficient heat to melt the ice. And in those days of innocence, he thought, well, somebody must know that this is okay. And one day he was at a House of Commons briefing, and he explained that these pools had to be covered with water, otherwise the rods would get a runaway temperature and would burn and reduce radioactive particles into the environment. When he saw the expressions of the public and his bosses, he realised that he should focus on other parts of the industry. He's concerned that the European pressure water reactors, is what the new EDF project is called, has a number of frightening concepts. Although the government say they require uranium and simple products to be used for the fuel, There is a potential use of MOX, which is a kind of recycled spent fuel process. John Large has pointed out that if the temptation is to make a bit more money by using the spent fuel reprocessing, that there will be a large number of exotic radioactive particles coming off, the like of which we have never had before. We already know from the old AGR reactors that decommissioning and waste handling will cost, from official figures, £35 billion. And that's just a rough estimate. And official figures, again, suggest that nuclear waste from the legacy of old reactors will have to be monitored and contained for hundreds of thousands of years.
Well, if that isn't food for thought, then I don't know what is. So lastly, Colin, tell us, what can people do? Who can they get in touch with if they want to find out more, in particular in reference to Hinkley right on our doorsteps?
Well, I think Stop Hinkley is probably your first port of call. Unfortunately, one of the petitions has just run out of time, but Stop Hinkley is always having information about petitions that people can write to register their protest. But I would also encourage people to look at 7tidal.com and CGEN, based in Stoke Gifford, who have information about wonderful options in tidal protection for the estuary and power which is cheaper and more plentiful than the present nuclear proposal. In fact, if you consider that the present AGR reactor is producing 6 terawatts of power per annum, the Minehead to Aberthaw Reef, which is environmentally sensitive project, will produce something around 20 terawatts per hour per annum.
Okay. I'm afraid I've got to stop there. We really needed longer to sort of chat about that, really. But I would certainly recommend to people who are listening, if you are interested, here are a few websites that you can certainly have a look at. 7tidal.com, as Colin mentioned earlier, regarding the Minehead to Aberthaw Reef. Greenworldtrust.org.uk. Yes to Wind, Re-Economic and Other Challenges to the Nuclear Debate, is worth looking at. And thank you very much for joining us on Dialect this evening. We'll bring you more on that story, and we've had previous guests on the show talk about it before as well, so I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. Thank you. This is Chili B and Born Suspicious.
When I was born, I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
When I was born suspicious, suspected of a crime that I didn't commit yet. But I just say bet, maybe it's my DNA, my genetical breakdown, because I'm skin brown. Homie is the clown that we all love to see on TV, but homie the clown ain't me, see? I kick the dick swift, cooler than Kool-Aid, and I can go off on the mic like a hand grenade. But still I chill because they expect me to have no respect for me, see? I ain't going out like a villain. I'm an anti-trigger happy nigga that's chillin'. Wake up, it's time for the brothers to wake up. See through the makeup. They don't know me, but they fear me, because I might be vicious. And I was born suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious. When I was born, I was born suspicious.
Damn, I can't even walk the streets at night without being harassed by the police. They say we all look alike. Well, that's a stereotype. Like P.E. said, don't believe the hype. Now they wanna rough me up and lock me down. They got my face in the crown. Black man with a phone in custody. So now they wanna take my fingerprints and ID.
It's not enough, they wanna rough me up and scuff me up. 14 police just to cuff me up. I guess there's no caviar dreams and champagne wishes when you're born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
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 Right.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
Chili B, of course. I couldn't read my own writing. My apologies to him. That's Born Suspicious, the title track from a six-track CD from Alternative Tentacles.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Last week, Thursday the 20th of November, was the 7th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. Dalek's reporter Anthea Page joined a group of Bristol doctors who had converged on College Green to pay their tributes to the people who had died in the conflict.
Marine Gail Gostick, age 22, killed in a blast in the area of Sangin in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on the 25th of May, 2008.
Sher Ali Akar, 75, killed by a NATO airstrike in the village of Tajal, Helmand Province, Afghanistan, in April 2008.
Private Daniel Gamble, age 22, killed by a suicide bomber while patrolling on foot in the area of Sangin, in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on the 8th of June, 2008.
My name is Dr. Chris Burns Cox, and I used to be a consultant at French A Hospital. A group of doctors, totally varied people. We don't work in any particular organisation, but we felt that somehow or other, this being the 7th anniversary of the so-called successful invasion of Afghanistan, we should remember some of the people who've been killed. So we remember the names of 125 UK Armed Forces people who've died and been killed as a result of this war and occupation, and also 150 of the over 3,000 Afghan civilians whose names we know who've been killed since we started this war. So we're just remembering those names rather solemnly in great sorrow about the suffering and tragedies that the British have been associated with.
So are you doctors from Bristol?
We're all doctors who based in Bristol, yes.
My name is Dr. Michael Whitfield. I was a general practitioner in the centre of Bristol. And what we've been doing is reading out these names of people who have died in Afghanistan. Each one of us reads out the name of an Afghan, and then 30 seconds later we read out the name of an English soldier who has been killed in that country.
Personal contact with anyone who's lost a son in Afghanistan or daughter?
No, we've had no direct contact in that way.
What sparked you initially to have this
commemoration? A sadness, really. And we don't want the British to forget, be able to forget, to be allowed to forget the brutality of what we've been doing and the tragic death of these people, let alone for every death there's a lot more people seriously wounded. Just think of the suffering which has been associated with the British invasion of Afghanistan. So we're just reminding people we can't bear to let this thing go unsaid.
So what about Iraq then?
Well,
why Afghanistan and not
Iraq? The 7th anniversary today of our invasion of Afghanistan. That's why we're doing it today.
But are you doing anything about Iraq as well or not?
Well, individually, I'm sure we're all members of various organisations. But today we're just concentrating on this 7th anniversary and thinking about Afghanistan. Iraq is even more appalling, but that's for another day.
And have you had much public reaction?
No, not a great deal. But you never know how this sort of thing affects people. Just people who walk by and notice it. They may then discuss it amongst themselves, think about it. But no, we haven't got a great response. Radio Bristol hasn't shown any interest. The Evening Post hasn't shown any interest. But that's the way of the world. They're more interested in other things.
Every day there's somebody being mentioned on the television or the radio, certainly of British soldiers being killed. But at the same time, as a British soldier is being killed, there are Afghans dying too and being damaged in incredible ways.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Thank you to Anthea for bringing us that report on the Afghanistan vigil. And now on a lighter note, it's time for Cider with Rosie.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. Moody, majestic Uncle Sid was the fourth but not least of my mother's brothers. This small, powerful man, at first a champion cricketer, had a history blighted by rheumatism. He was a bus driver too after he left the army, put in charge of our first double-deckers. Those solid, tired, open-topped passenger chariots were the leviathans of the roads at the time. Staggering siege towers, which often ran wild and got their top decks caught under bridges. Our Uncle Sid, one of the elite of the bus drivers, became a famous sight in the district. It was a thing of pride and some alarm to watch him go thundering by, perched up high in his reeking cabin, his face sweating beer and effort, while he wrenched and wrestled at the steering wheel to hold the great bus on its course. Each trip through town destroyed roof tiles and gutters and shook the gas mantles out of the lamps, but he always took pains to avoid women and children, and scarcely ever mounted the pavement. Runaway roarer, freighted with human souls, stampeder of policemen and horses, it was Uncle Sid with his mighty hands who mastered its mad career. Uncle Sid's story began in the South African War. As a private soldier, he had earned a reputation for silence, cunning and strength. His talent for cricket, learned on the molehills of Sheepscombe, endowed him with special privileges. Quite soon he was chosen to play for the army, and was being fed on the choicest rations. The hell-bent technique of his village game worked havoc among the officers. This is probably the peak of my Uncle Sid's glory, the time he would most wish to remember. From then on, his tale shows a certain fall, though it still flared up on occasions. There was, for instance, the day of the outing, when our village took three charabangs to Clevedon, with Uncle Sid driving the leading one, a crate of beer at his feet. "Put her in top, Uncle Sid," we cried, as we roared through the summer country. Guzzling with one hand, steering with the other, he drove through the flying winds, while we bounced and soared above the tops of the hedges, made airborne by this man at the wheel. Then, on our way home at the end of the day, we were stopped by a woman's screams. She stood by the roadside with a child in her arms, cringing from a threatening man. The tableau froze for us all to see. The wild-haired woman, the wailing child, the man with his arm upraised. Our charabangs came to a shuddering halt, and we all started shouting at once. We leaned over the sides of our open wagons and berated the man for a scoundrel. Our men from their seats insulted him roundly, suggesting he leave the poor woman alone. But our Uncle Sid just folded his coat, climbed down from his cab without speaking, walked up to the bully, swung back his arm, and knocked the man straight through the hedge. Life to him was black and white, and he'd reacted to it simply. Scowling with pride, he returned to the wheel and drove us home a hero. Uncle Sid differed in no way from all his other brothers, in chivalry, temper, and drink. He could knock down a man or a glass of beer as readily and neatly as they, but his job as a bus driver and his rheumatism both increased and obstructed his thirst. The result exposed him to official censure, and it was here that the fates laid him low. When he married my Aunt Alice and became a father of two children, his job promised to anchor his wildness, but the law was against him, and he soon got into scrapes. He was the best double-decker driver in Stroud, without doubt. Even safer, more inspired when he drank. Everybody knew this, except the bus company. He began to get lectures, admonitions, stern warnings, and finally suspensions without pay. When this last thing happened, out of respect for Aunt Alice, he always committed suicide. Indeed, he committed suicide more than any man I know, but always in the most reasonable manner. If he drowned himself, then the canal was dry. If he jumped down a well, so was that. And when he drank disinfectant, there was always an antidote ready, clearly marked, to save everyone's trouble. He reasoned quite rightly that Aunt Alice's anger on hearing of another suspension would be swallowed up by her larger anxiety on finding him again near to death. And Auntie Alice never failed him in this, and forgave him each time he recovered. The bus company were almost equally forgiving. They took him back again and again. Then, one night, having brought his bus safely home, they found him fast asleep at the wheel, reeking of malt and stone jar cider, and they gave him the sack for good. We were sitting in the kitchen rather late that night, when a loud knock came at the door. A hollow voice called, "Annie? Annie?" And we knew that something had happened. Then the kitchen door crept slowly open and revealed three dark-clad figures. It was Auntie Alice and her two small daughters, each dressed in their Sunday best. They stood at the foot of the kitchen steps, silent as apparitions, and Aunt Alice's face, with its huge, drawn eyes, wore a mantle of tragic doom. "He's done it this time," she intoned at last. "That's what. I know he has." Her voice had a church-like incantation which dropped crystals of ice down my back. She held the small, pretty girls in a majestic embrace while they squirmed and sniffed and giggled. "He never came home. They must have given him the sack. Now he's gone off to end it all." "No, no," cried our mother. "Come and sit down, my dear." And she drew her towards the fire. "Where else could I go, Annie? He's gone down to Dedcombe. He always told me he would." She suddenly turned and seized Mother's hands, her dark eyes rolling madly. "Annie, Annie, he'll do himself in. Your boys, they just got to find him." So Jack and I put on caps and coats and went out into the half-moon night. From so much emotion, I felt light-headed. I wanted to laugh or hide. But Jack was his cool, intrepid self, tight-lipped as a gunboat commander. We were men in a crisis, on a secret mission. So we stuck close together and trudged up the valley, heading for Dedcombe Wood. The wood was a waste of rotting silence, transformed by its mask of midnight. A fine rain was falling, wet ferns soaked our legs, leaves shuddered with owls and water. What were we supposed to do, we wondered. Why had we come, anyway? We beat up and down through the dripping trees, calling, "Uncle!" in chill, flat voices. What should we find? Perhaps nothing at all. Or worse, what we had come to seek. But we remembered the women, waiting fearfully at home. Our duty, though dismal, was clear. So we stumbled and splashed through invisible brooks, followed paths skirted ominous shadows. We poked bits of stick into piles of old leaves, prodded foxholes, searched the length of the wood. There was nothing there but the fungoid darkness. Nothing at all but our fear. We were about to go home, and gladly enough, when suddenly we saw him. He was standing tiptoe under a great dead oak, with his braces around his neck. The elastic noose, looped to the branch above him, made him bob up and down like a puppet. We approached the contorted figure with dread. We saw his baleful eye fixed on us. Our Uncle Sid was in a terrible temper. "You've been a bloody long time," he said.
Read by an abridged full dialect, especially by Malcolm Grieve.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve as ever, and I think we have another episode next week. It's now time for Walking Backwards by Manifesto.
buildings are cracked and decaying. If I'd have seen her, I wouldn't have stayed. Commotion that I couldn't take.
Manifesto on Fire Records, a 12-inch, and that's Walking Backwards.
That was Walking Backwards by Manifesto. We reached that, as you may have gathered from a recording. Thank you, Tony Gosling, of John Peel, who we're all quite keen on here at Dialect. Hopefully in the new year, we would like to put a night or something together to celebrate the man's life. So if you have any suggestions or interesting ideas about it, or just any memories of it, you can always contact us here at the show. Our email address currently is hearingbristol@gmx.co.uk. It's now time for What's On, bearing in mind music. Here's Jess Bartz to tell us.
Good evening, this is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday 5th of December, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, Ed Tudorpole will be performing with support from the exhibition. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Also on 5th of December and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, the Blues Cowboys will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I bring to you a band called Blackstone Cherry. This group formed in 2001 and in their career have released 3 EPs and 3 albums. The latest album was released this year and is titled Folklore and Superstition. And here is a track from that album titled Peace is Free.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
That was Blackstone Cherry with Peace Is Free from their Folklore and Superstition album. For more information on them, you can check out www.blackstonecherry.com. Moving on to Saturday, 6th of December, and at the Trinity Centre in Bristol, Stackridge will be performing with support from the Toy Hearts. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 6th of December, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, John Otway and his band will be performing. Doors open at 5pm and tickets are £12 in advance. And also on 6th of December, at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, Cable Co. will be performing. Doors open at 8pm and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, I come to Sunday, 7th of December, and at the Royal Oak, which is at 81 Broad Street in Chipping Sodbury, Angel Up Front will be performing. Doors open at 8pm and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's now time for Matt Lewis's feature, If I Were Prime Minister. If you are very eagle-eared, if such a thing exists, you might have spotted at the beginning of the show that I said his name was Matt Heap. He's just married and he's dropped his surname. He's taken his wife's. So sorry, Matt, if you're listening to this. Mike Bourne from St George in Bristol. That's who we're hearing from today. He works in education and believes schools in Britain have become overly regulated and he wants to get rid of the obsession with targets.
Welcome back to the studio. We've got another Prime Minister and they're coming in their droves. This time it's...
Mike Bourne.
Welcome to the studio, Mike. You've got loads of post-it notes of crazy writing on. You obviously have some stuff that you want to get out there. What would you pass as your first law if you were Prime Minister for the day?
If I was Prime Minister for the day, the first one would be some sort of law which decreases the amount of accountability that there currently is in government. It's one of my sort of pet peeves at the moment. I don't believe that there is a need for there to be as the current amount that there currently is. The government would argue that to be open and transparent, we need it. And yes, whilst I agree with that, I don't agree with it at the expense of stifling and making things too regimental, especially in relation to sort of public service delivery. I think there should be more trust that gets put back into people. So less accountability, sort of more trust, for me is the main thing I would do. Second one, I would look at doing, again, a sort of more educational route, is scrapping the current extent of testing which we have. For me, it's unnecessary.
So you're a particular fan of the SATs being given the axe in?
I would definitely go along with that, yeah. I really don't. Again, I think it's just tied to the accountability, really. I think it's just accountability and testing for the sake of it. So the Prime Minister can, the previous Prime Minister, I should say, as I'm currently in his role, can look good at Prime Minister's question time and say we've done X, Y and Z. But in terms of real impact for people, I don't really think they care about that. They think about whether the children are being children and whether things are actually getting done. I don't really think they give a hoot about whether X percent are doing this, that and the other. I really don't. I'm not saying we should scrap it, but at all. But yes, the extent to which we're doing it, for me, is too much.
Okay, good point. I mean, there must be a huge amount of government resources devoted to actually collecting evidence into pie charts and bar charts and proving that money's well spent. And if a section of that was jettisoned, there'd be a huge amount of money freed up to actually make the changes rather than record them. So point taken. Okay, what would your next law be?
The final one, well, not the final one, the sort of more serious one that I do is I would look to try and reduce the extent of employer and the sort of current stage where we are in the sort of education, the employer has a pretty big seat at the table. It's driving a lot of what we're doing. For me, I'm a bit concerned about that and the slippery slope we may be going on. I think 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, do I really want my children to be the main things they're learning is how to influence, how to manipulate, how to sell to people, which is at the basis of what the current system is based around, capitalist system. So I suppose it's slightly anti-capitalist in my views there. But I don't want my children to be learning that. I want my children to be learning about sort of fundamental thinking skills in relation to education. So for me, it's quite a key issue. It's almost like a battle for the soul of education itself at the moment. And I don't like the direction that we're going in. So I'd look to reduce the extent of employer involvement in qualifications, that sort of stuff.
So education should be more, in your eyes, than just proving the its worth to the economy. Education has a value in its own right for just learning, rather than having to prove it makes money or fits in with the economy.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I don't see things, and I don't think we should be driven by the economy effectively, and where we are in a particular league table against different particular countries. I do think learning should be for learning's sake, and I think that if we give younger people, children, the sort of fundamental learning skills, you know, in relation to language, sentence construction, but then also thinking skills as well, so, you know, bringing possibly philosophy back into the curriculum earlier on, which just gives them that grounding, then they can go whichever direction they want. That's what, you know, people really want, employers, businesses, that sort of stuff. They want the ability to think and think laterally, which you get from doing that, not just by having to manipulate this, that and the other. So that's one of the other ones that I would look at doing.
Okay, cool. Do you have any other pearls of wisdom for us?
Not sure if we would call it a pearl of wisdom or not, but for me, final big beef is sport. There's currently a list of sports that should be on national television, and at the moment Test Match Cricket and the Ryder Cup were taken off that years ago for reasons beyond me. If it was me, I would bring them back tomorrow. They are in the wider public interest.
Okay, well, sport is a major source of escapism for a lot of people, and how do they watch these things now? Because I don't particularly watch sport, I must admit, but if I was going to watch Ryder Cup or the Test Match, if it's not on mainstream telly, what do I have to pay? Who do I have to pay to watch it?
Unfortunately, you have to take out a fair wedge of cash, probably 40 quid a month, to watch it on Sky or Satanta Sports, which, for the majority of people in my, and for the population that I look after as Prime Minister, can't really afford that. So I would look to almost instantly make that, actually I probably would make that the first Act of Parliament, a statutory Act of Parliament, is to bring back Test Match Cricket and the Ryder Cup.
I reckon you're going to get a few votes on this. Thank you very much, Mike. We'll see what the listeners think. Thank you.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
Thank you to Mike Bourne and thank you to Matt Lewis. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a community internet radio station, broadcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk, and broadcast from 93.2 across the city of Bristol, and also across the city of Preston. Visit preston.fm on the internet. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, either in reporting or on the engineering side, please do get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guest Colin Rogers today, who came in with a formidable amount of preparation. What a man. Reports this week with Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Thanks to Matt Lewis for his If I Were Prime Minister feature, more next week. And more Jeff Sparks, thank you for his weekly What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. Studio production this week was by Mark Condon, the producer was Tony Gosling. Next week we have Blue Beyond, a two-piece singer-songwriter, live in the studio. That was Dialect Radio, and this is John Peters Coleman wishing you a very good week. From all the team here in Queen Square Studio, until we all get blown away in the Hinkley Blast, take care of yourselves. We'll be right back.